Welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I'm delighted to be able to speak today to the current mayor of Cape Town and soon to be, more likely than not, leader of the Democratic Alliance, Jordan Hill-Lewis. Jordan, welcome and thank you for coming onto the podcast. And before we start, please let me just read from the manuscript of a book about to appear, I believe, in time for the Franschhoek Literary Festival. And written by a colleague of mine on Business Day who I've never met, called Tara Ruiz. And it's absolutely fabulous. The book is going to be called Where To From Here. But I want to read an extract to you because it's a kind of thing around which we can structure our discussion. And she's talking about the last election and who won and who lost and who merely survived. And you'll be pleased to know the DA, unlike the ANC, is among the survivors. But she says, and I want to just read from it, the Democratic Alliance is second largest party, at the time when the ANC, this is 2024, suffered its most severe collapse, the DA merely nudged upward, advancing incrementally in a context where realignment seem not only possible, but probable. And then she says, this stagnation cannot be attributed to organizational complacency. The DA ran a disciplined, well-resourced campaign built around governance, credibility, institutional reform, and anti-corruption commitments. Yet the party's message had insufficient emotional weight to resonate with an electorate experiencing acute social and economic distress. The DA's technocratic style and policy-driven rhetoric consistently struggle, she says, to reach communities for whom politics is first and foremost a question of dignity, belonging, and historical redress. The DA is caught between the expectations of its traditional base, supporters who prize fiscal discipline, constitutionalism, market-oriented reform, and the demands of a broader electorate living with the legacies of inequality and exclusion. So, Jordan, I thank you once again for waiting through that. You're in a wonderful position now. You're about to become or be elected, unless some macabre thing occurs. Leader of the DA. And the DA is in a really nice position. You know, you've got a process anchor in the Western Cape and through yourself in Cape Town. But as Tara Roos is saying, you're not moving in the polls on the ground. Obviously, there are, you know, with the latest results and by-elections, latest last election results, current by-election, don't show much movement. The polls are very excited about you, but they're just polls. They're not elections. Under your leadership, Jordan, how would the DA get from, you know, going along steadily to really motoring? You'd think that with an exhausted ANC in charge, your timing couldn't be better.
I agree that it is very, very good timing. There is a lot of opportunity in South African politics. But, you know, if it was easy, it would have been done already. It was very, very well written and very eloquently written, the passage that you read. But I do chuckle at people commenting on politics and really not quite understanding how tough electoral politics and hyper-competitive electoral politics in South Africa is. It is a really tough space. But that said, we have to be firmly focused on growth. And I've set out an agenda of four quick points that I'd like to go through for how I think we can position the DA to take advantage of this opportunity that you and Tara have spoken about. First, I've said it must be unequivocal and undeniably the case for every South African that they see that the DA governs the best, and that we do so for every resident. To that point, that we deliver growing levels of dignity, growing levels of historical redress through being the best in government and being the best in government for everyone. Then second, I said that we have to close the gap. We have to be closer to the millions of South Africans who have not voted for us in the past and start to build that trust relationship. Because I think the one word that was missing from that list was that, voters are driven by those that voter decisions, rather, are driven by those that they trust. So you have to build that trust relationship. Then third, we have to be strong in government. We have to show all voters that we are not simply in the GNU to go along to get along, that we're there to influence the direction of the state and influence it according to our values, so that because we know that those are the only values that are going to fix South Africa. And finally, we have to proudly champion the cause of the future of South Africa. There is a strain in our politics that's incredibly negative and down on South Africa's future, and we are not that. We are very patriotic and passionate South Africans, and we want South Africa to succeed, and we believe we can make it succeed. So I think if we do those four things with discipline and focus, and as you say, with emotional resonance, I think that is an absolutely key point, then we can get... closer to the opportunity you speak of.
So, Jordan, I mean, in a way, what you're doing is expanding on what you said when you were nominated a couple of weeks ago. You said you wanted to get people who'd never voted for the DA to vote for it, right? And in other words, to win votes that you've never won before, maybe even to chase votes that you've never chased before. How would you do that, though? I mean, what has to change?
I think that people who have never voted for us before have to come to an understanding or be persuaded, be convinced of the fact that the DA is going to sort things out in government for them, that South Africa is going to get better as a result, and indeed that their lives are going to see benefit out of that. So that even when they come to the polls in 3 years' time, in 2029 at our next national election, even if they still have residual concerns about the DA, they come to the polls knowing a few things. These guys, the DA, are the best, undeniably the best in government. Despite whatever concerns I may still have, I can see that they are really trying to govern for everyone in South Africa. I can see in my own life that various things have got better because of the efforts that they've made. And I can see that they genuinely care about the issues that I care about in my life. If all of those voters who have never voted for us before, or even a significant portion of them, can be clear about those impressions by the time we go to the polls, then I strongly believe that a significant portion of them will vote for us.
But what I'm asking is that in order to, you know, you have a fairly conservative base, and clearly the people, and I'm going to assume this, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the people who've never voted for the DA before and the people you're talking to are black voters. How do you persuade your base to go with you on this journey to get the new black votes? And as you can see, you know, the parties like the PA are on one side of the ideological spectrum are nibbling away at some of your support in the Western Cape amongst colored voters. How do you keep the ship together while you while you try to persuade, because you have to, these new voters who may not look anything like your base?
No, I think that's a great question. Firstly, before I answer that, I just want to say I think it's important that we try. We are the only party in South Africa that bothers to try. It is a difficult thing keeping all of those constituencies together and trying to grow them over time. No one else in the South African political landscape is even vaguely concerned with that question or that problem. They just pursue their own tiny niche of the electoral market and do so, relentlessly. And they have the luxury of being able to do so, but that's not going to build a better and more prosperous future for the country. So we are going to try to do that. And I think that's an important point to make, is that we are the only ones actually trying to do that. Now, again, it's a tough thing to do. But I do think that you just build credibility over time. And to your point about what has to change, I think you have to, I think all voters and all DA voters understand maths. And if you want to actually fundamentally change the country, you have to get your hand on the steering wheel of the state. Now, at the moment, we might have one finger on the steering wheel of the state, but we certainly don't have our hand on it yet. And so if we want to really change South Africa, if we really want to fix it and make it more prosperous for everyone, we have to grow, we have to win. And that requires reaching out to new voters. So I think people are much more comfortable with that idea than we give them credit for, because I think most South Africans actually understand that at a very deep level. Then as to what must change, well, we have to slowly but surely build credibility with those voters by making it clear in the things that we choose to talk about. There's a million things that you can choose to talk about every day. In the things that we choose to talk about, we must make it clear that we genuinely care and are interested in their advancement and the bettering of their lives, the issues that they are anxious about, the concerns that they have for the future of their kids and families, that those are the things that motivate and rev us up as well. And over time, that helps you to build credibility and that relationship of trust. And then what's important to me is just being present in their communities, not showing up very intermittently when you're asking for support. And I know that requires a lot of commitment and time and effort, but you have to do that. You have to be present. But I enjoy doing that. That's one of the things that I really do like doing is going around and meeting a whole lot of new people. I intend to do that a lot.
Yeah. So after the 2019 general election,
2019,
which Musi Maimane was reckoned to have handled very badly, the party shed a lot of black leadership or senior black membership, and it also decided to stop using race as a proxy for disadvantage in its policies. And that all seemed, I have to say, and I've said it a million times, seemed crazy to me in a country with our history. This is South Africa we're talking about, not Canada. And but it was a serious change of direction in 2019, because up until then the party had gone out of its way to attract black leaders into it, as you will know. Anyway, what I wanted to ask you was, were you comfortable with that decision to stop using race as a proxy for disadvantage? And if you weren't, now that you're about to become the leader, what are you going to do about it?
Well, yes, I was. But before I get to that, let me just say that this discussion is often premised on this kind of simplistic choice, which assumes that because we oppose the use of a definition of race in law, we do not care about the advancement of black South Africans. And nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's really important to premise the discussion. We deeply care about the advancement of people who still live in poverty in South Africa, the overwhelming majority of whom are black South Africans. We deeply care about getting them out of poverty, getting them into jobs, so that we can start to help them build a better life, and so that they can also build a better life for themselves and for their families. And in fact, all of our track record shows that we are actually the best party in doing so. Here in Cape Town, where I've had the privilege of being in government these last 4 years, we've created more jobs than all of the other metro cities in South Africa combined. The huge majority of those jobs have gone to poor people in Cape Town, and those are overwhelmingly people who are black or colored Capetonians and South Africans. So the idea that we are not concerned with the issue of black advancement is fallacious. It's wrong. We are deeply concerned with that, but we do not believe that it's in South Africa's best interests for us to actually have a legally defined definition of what someone's race is in the law. That there are better ways for us to measure actual disadvantage than the immutable characteristics of one's birth. and that those are better things for our country's future. That is not to say that that race is irrelevant. It's not to say that we are not concerned with black advancement. Quite the opposite. But it is to say that for the future of our country, we don't think that we need to have a definition, a legal definition of what one race is and what another race is not. Because of course, and this is what is never answered by proponents of the opposite system, perhaps you can answer it now, is how you actually get involved in the awful business of classification. Because when you have a definition in law, you have to be able to decide marginal cases. And we know South Africa's history with that. And it's a terrible history, and we should never want to breathe new life into it, which is why we don't.
Yeah. I wasn't necessarily talking about putting racial laws onto the statute book. What I was asking, I think, was whether the DA would become more relaxed in the future about talking about black people as they are blacks, as they are black people.
Oh, I see.
And I only say this because in order to talk to somebody, they need to know that you know what they feel about themselves. And to a large extent, you know, Jordan, what a lot of people feel in this country about it starts with what color they are. It's just a fact. Whites as well as blacks.
Let me just say.
And so.
There's a bit of a delay on the line, but let me just say, Peter, and specifically to all.
It's not good at all. Yeah.
To all black South Africans, that we are deeply interested, committed, passionate about their advancement, and particularly those who still live in poverty and unemployment. And who still have not seen the material benefits that political and democratic freedom has brought with. Now, I'm perfectly comfortable saying that from every platform, on every stage, and intend to say it often and frequently all around the country. I do not want our position to be pigeonholed as being against that, because nothing could be further from the truth. That's actually why we, you know, getting people out of poverty is why we are in politics.
So, fine. That's a good answer for now. Just before I move on to another aspect of the conversation, you see no need to change written DA policy as you take over the party. In a month's time.
In every respect.
Not every respect, but in respect of these core values. You very remember the process that happened. It was, you know, Musi Maimane got blamed for the election result. There was a commission inquiry into the election. He was blamed, and a couple of people then left, and other people left. And then the following year, there was a Congress, and the Congress said, this is the last time we are, you know, we're just never going to talk about race as a proxy for disadvantage again. And in fact, up until then, it had served the DA quite well. Since then, the DA has not all made all that much headway, to be honest, certainly not amongst black voters. And I think I was asking you, and I understand it's a difficult question to answer, but whether those were destructive times and whether it was necessary to have taken a position like that.
Those were destructive times in the sense that the public could not see clearly the absolute distinguishing factor, the unique distinguishing thing that made the DA different from the raft of other political parties on the ballot paper, whatever it is now, 140 of them. When a party loses its unique selling point like that, its unique distinguishing factor, it's, you know, voters must ask, what is the point? What is it that I'm specifically getting out of the faith that I'm putting in this political party by lending them my vote? And so I do think that was was necessary to firm up the party. John used this fabulous phrase, the wobbly blue jelly. And people don't want a wobbly blue jelly, and that's also not what's going to fix our country. we need to have much firmer stuff than that, and much clearer leadership. And I think part of our absolute decades long historical clear position has been the liberal democratic position in South African politics, to say that we should not, if we believe in what the Constitution says when it speaks of a true non-racial democracy, the ANC often uses that phrase, even though I'm not sure what they mean by it.
Yeah.
They mean anything but that.
Yeah.
Then we should not have these definitions in law, and we should find ways to, and I think quite easily done, to measure actual disadvantage. And the huge, overwhelming majority of beneficiaries of such a policy would be Black South Africans, but not because they are any particular race or born any particular way, but because they are born in poverty, and we must correct that.
Yeah.
Jordan, how ready do you think the party is for a new broom? I mean, you're an incredibly young guy, you know, you're 40 later this year. And I remember a year ago, John Steenhuisen was adamant, and more recently even than a year ago, adamant that he wanted to stand for re-election as DA leader next month. And I clearly remember you saying on more than one occasion that he was your friend and that you wouldn't stand against him if he decided to stand. So what happened? Something must have happened inside the party or between the two of you. What can you tell us about how he came to decide to step away and you came to decide to step up?
I think a couple of things happened. Firstly, the ministerial schedule is just absolutely brutal. And that's a big part of why I decided that it would be most unwise for me to take up any position in the national cabinet at this stage, and why I would prefer to stay here in the mayor's office where I'm talking to you from now. You've got to go to Pretoria several days a week to be with your department. Then you've got to travel to every corner of the country doing your ministerial work. Then you've got to come back home and then get back on a plane to do political work. Then you've got to be abroad many times at the behest of the president and so on. You've got the constant pressure of having a government department that is broken. There's not a single one of those government departments that is functional. All of them are in varying degrees of dilapidation. And so you have to roll up your sleeves and get stuck in and actually fixing and building an institution. It's just relentless, Peter, just relentless. And I see, because many of those six ministers are...
No, I wanted to ask, just a couple of weeks before he announced that he wasn't going to be standing for re-election, he was telling a podcast, I think it was on the Common Sense, that he was. So it seemed to all gel fairly late in the day. I know there were party ructions around Dion George, and foot and mouth have become a big thing, and it may be completely out of control. Was it a bit of was this a bit of a surprise to you too? If he was saying, in February that he was going to stay, were you thinking in February as well that this is not going to happen? Or did you by then have some... I'm just wondering what sort of... how much time you've had to prepare yourself.
No, not long. I mean, when I had coffee with John in December, just before he went on holiday, that was the last time I saw him before this announcement. We had a coffee together in December, and he was about to go on his Christmas holiday with his family. And he told me that he was definitely, he was resolute and decided that he was going to stand again, and that was absolutely fine by me, as I'd said several times publicly. So I had very little preparation. I had not done a great deal of recruiting campaign team members or anything like that. So I had to jump to it when he informed me about his decision not to stand. But I had always said publicly that if there was a vacancy, I would seriously consider standing. And I'd said that to him, openly, that if this was a decision that he was considering, I would probably make myself available. So, of course, there had been some thinking in the back of my head. It wasn't like the thought had never crossed my mind. Let me be quite clear. That's not the case. But I certainly did not know that he had changed his mind up until the last minute.
And it's interesting, though, because there is a real sense, as other nominations for other jobs at the coming conference or Congress have come up and been nominated, there's a real sense of renewal in a way, and certainly in the leadership, younger people, more rainbow colors. It could end up looking really quite refreshingly different and be a good place for you to start.
Yes, and that has just happened entirely organically, and I think that's a great, it's a great aspect of this Congress that I hope gets the attention it deserves. We've got people like Siviwe and Ashore and Solly and Salia coming through the ranks, all standing for election inside the party leadership. There's others, Ricardo and Carl and others. So there's a whole lot of people that are just coming that are an entirely different much younger generation, and so you might see this generational shift in the leadership of South Africa's second biggest political party, soon to be biggest, and I think that's very exciting.
And Jordan, are you then all just one big happy family? I mean, surely you have arguments amongst each other about aspects of policy. What do DA members disagree about? Disagree the most about, behind closed doors?
Yeah, look, I think there's a great degree of unanimity at the moment around what our strategic objectives have to be for 2029. There's an absolute focus on winning these cities later this year, because that is a critical step towards our 29 strategy. If we can demonstrate turnaround in these cities, particularly in South Africa's population and economic center in Gauteng, that's a really, really big deal and so important for our political objectives. And again, to our earlier discussion, particularly if we demonstrate that we govern best for everyone, for every member of society. And there's a lot of unanimity on that. I think there was concern. There still is concern. This might be something that comes up in conversation. To answer your question around, are we differentiating ourselves sufficiently inside the government of national unity? And of course, that's not a simple answer, as I tried to be honest about in my launch speech, which you've clearly read. It's you have to walk the line between when to cooperate and when to compete, when to fight, when to draw a line, so on. And that's not an easy question. But so long as voters can see that the DA is trying to instill and imbue the state with our values and our ethics, because those are the things that are actually going to fix the state.
But stick with the GNU for a moment. Then you I know that you said that you support the DA having gone in, and that's fine. You're going to remain mayor of Cape Town and lead the party from the office you're sitting in now. But won't that make your job as a national political leader a bit harder? I mean, I can see the advantages of not being in the cabinet. You don't get stuck with foot and mouth disease or something else that you can't control and which makes you end up looking ineffective. But you're still going to have to work harder than otherwise to become a household name in, I don't know, Limpopo.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's true, but there's no job in politics that comes without incredibly hard work. I'm not afraid of that. That's not the biggest challenge. What I have to, the biggest challenge for me, firstly, is a personal challenge, Peter. To be honest, is I must first and foremost, the most important thing in my life is to be a good father. So I have to have some semblance of ability to continue doing that. And I've made that work quite well in the mayor's office, and I intend to make it work. That's non-negotiable. It has to continue to work. And so when I just look at the schedule of those colleagues, I just think that's not really a sustainable thing for many people. But then of course it comes with the downside that you've got to get out there in the country and make yourself known and so on, and I intend to do just that. I do think it's important to say, in the context of your question on the GNU, I do think that there is there's something healthy about having some distance from the cabinet and the president, because it gives me the space and the freedom to say precisely what I want to say. The president's not my boss. I don't rely on him for any grace or favor, and and so I can be as muscular and forthright as I want to be, and I think there's something healthy about that.
Yeah. So just stay with that position. I mean, what sort of relationship would be ideal with the president? You know, if he wanted to move a DA minister and you didn't approve of that, what would you do? And quite honestly, if you wanted to move a minister, as John Steenhuisen did with Dion George, would you be able to, you know, what sort of, do you already have a relationship with him as the mayor of Cape Town, with Cyril Ramaphosa or any of the obviously likely successors? How's that going to work for you? I mean, to the extent that you can control it.
Well, I always joke with the president that he is a resident in my city and spends most of his time here. So, you know, I instead of him having a sword, I have a sword, because if he likes having lights and water, then he must answer my calls. But of course, I say that in jest. I'm sure. I have no idea, but I'm sure his bills are up to date. But you know, I have a good relationship with the president, and we don't speak often. I only see him or talk to him once every few months, and I suppose that's going to have to become much more regular now. But there is a document that governs the Government of National Unity Coalition Agreement, and obviously the party leaders have got the wherewithal to say who they want representing their team in the around the cabinet table. And that must be done in discussion with the president. Ultimately, he's got to sign the letters. But it is our prerogative to appoint, as we see fit.
Yeah. And as you're going into, you know, an election cycle of sorts over a couple of years, just go back to the opposition. You know, a lot of people make the obvious point that the black nationalist vote in South Africa is still huge, even though it's divided now between the ANC and Mkhonto we Sizwe party and the Economic Freedom Fighters. I mean, it's still the biggest block of votes that exists, however it may have fragmented. How do you emotionally and ideologically tackle that in order to make headway? I mean, what in your mind are nationalists most vulnerable to? How do you attack nationalism? How do you make headway against it?
That is a good question. Well, you know, it's fundamentally an ideology and philosophy that has destroyed most of what works in South Africa. So I'm not sure that it has anything really to offer the voters by way of a track record of success, and has brought our country right to the brink of real disaster. So I think our strongest offer to the voters is that if you want South Africa to work, if you want public education to work and healthcare to work and your family to get a better future and your chances of getting work to improve dramatically and meaningfully, then there's really only one party in our entire political landscape on that long, endless ballot paper. There's only one party that has actually demonstrated the ability to do that, and that is the DA. That's something that I think we as a party can be very proud of. And that has to be a potent response to nationalism. I'm not to say it will always succeed, but I think in many cases it will. And I think more and more voters are primarily concerned with that. It's not about big philosophical arcs or ideological narratives. It's about the fact that Johannesburg is crumbling before our very eyes, and so many of our other cities are doing so as well. And all public services, there's not a single public service that is where it should be, or even where it was 10 years or 15 years ago. It has just been a relentless downward and backward slide. So it's time we reverse that, and it's time we start building again and start building for a better future for our country, and only we can do that.
I'm curious as to how you begin to, you say you're not going to change DA policy or approach, but how you begin to reshape it slightly then. Or a lot, and at the same time, not take us all again to yet another election, where, as has happened in 2019, as it's happened again in 2024, nobody has a clue what's going to happen to the DA before or after the election, because, you know, we're all supposed to wait until the result comes out, and then there's a frantic race to form a coalition or a partnership or whatever it might be, and the electorate is kind of left in the dark. So a lot of smaller parties outside of the national, big nationalist ones, are biting at your heels. And the PA, the Patrick Alliance, is growing, and quite often at the DA's expense in the Western Cape. I can tell you right now, in Stanford, where I live, you know, watch out. I don't know much about Action SA, but I thought the DA, for instance, reacted almost hysterically to the arrival of Songezo Zibi's Rise Mzansi party in 2024. It was pathetic. You know, he said one or two little things from a soapbox somewhere, and all guns were suddenly sort of trained on him. It was just ridiculous. But you can't fight on all of these fronts, and neither can you, keep on coming up with moonshot packs every time their pressure is on. And I wanted to ask you what your political instinct is. You know, do you wait for an election result before talking partnership, or do you get the partnerships done early? You know, I saw a mention the other day, Jordan, yesterday might have been, Prince Mashele, who I'm sure you've heard of, well-known commentator, forming what might be, according to the tweet that I saw, a precursor to an actual political party, which was interesting, I thought, because, you know, if it is, and if he's a conservative, popular black guy who isn't Herman Mashaba, who knows, you know? I mean, with a conservative electorate, that could make a big difference. So, you know, as these people come up and form parties, I know it's all very well to laugh. It all depends on how much money he gets. But how do you, you know, do our politics is extremely stressful for an ordinary voter. We never know what the shape of a government is going to look like until it's been an election. And then it's got to happen in a week or 2 weeks. It's crazy.
No, I don't think it matters how much money he gets. That idea is going nowhere slowly, or in fact, is going nowhere very quickly. And it's just, it's amazing that you would be taken in by such an idea again. I mean, how many times
I'm
does
not
this happen?
Taken in.
The
I'm not taken in by it. I'm just simply mentioning it.
No, I know, but you said it's exciting. But you know, I think there's already something like 140 political parties that contested the last election. You name your particular favorite niche, and there is already a political party in that space. Some of the parties that you mentioned, like Rise, were fantastically well-funded in the last election. They pulled all the big names, the big families, everyone, and they
absolutely
they just flopped like
crashed
and
burned
with a whimper, crashed and burned exactly, and that is entirely predictable, because it's actually to all of the critics and commentators, it's actually really tough to build a sustainable, real, meaningful political party that can stand the test of time in a country as geographically large, as linguistically diverse, as ethnically diverse, culturally diverse as ours. It's really tough. And I go back to the point that I made earlier. It is interesting to me that there's only really the DA that makes any go of trying to bring South Africa's disparate constituencies together. The rest just bulldoze ahead, focusing on their particular niche without any regard for trying to build a broad-based coalition, a broad church movement. We are trying to do something very different. We are actually trying to bring all South Africans from every corner and community together in the center of South African politics to build a broad-based movement that can be the biggest party in the country in 2029. Mm-hmm. That is an incredibly exciting and incredibly challenging a task. So, you know, I saw the tweet, I think it was, or the speech, I'm not sure what it was. I just saw a report on it about Prince. Prince is a nice guy, I know him. That's I have known him for a long time, but that is going nowhere very fast.
Yeah. The DA is what it is because it's been around for a long time and it stands its ground, et cetera, and it's built momentum. It's got a core that can't easily be taken away from it. Nonetheless, I was surprised, and you laughed at me, so I'll laugh at the response to the election in 2024, where suddenly panic stations. The ANC had done much worse than you thought it was going to do because Jacob Zuma had entered the fray. And you didn't have anything written down about what you were going to do if the ANC got 40% and you might have had the chance to form, to enter a government of national unity or a coalition or something. And so it had to be scrambled together very quickly. As you remember, a couple of books have been written about over those 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Before the GNU was formed, what would you do now? Would you start working on a coalition strategy now instead of being taken by surprise in 2029 if it's required of you? And if you do work out a GNU strategy now, a coalition strategy, how different would it be to what, Helen and John and Tony and all those people involved basically had to just take or leave because, it was the clock was ticking.
So let me just correct a few things. I think our internal polling ahead of the election had the ANC at 43 or 42, if I remember correctly. So it was not a surprise that the ANC was going to lose their majority. I think it was only a surprise to the ANC. They were still talking about getting a majority until the day before or something. But it was, the majority was off the cards. They then did even worse than that, getting just a hair shy of 40, 39.8.
That was what took you by surprise.
Yeah, they definitely did even worse than our expectations. But we had spent many meetings. I was a part of many of those, not all of them, but many of those meetings, just debating the various options and writing down copious scenarios about what's that other model, supply and confidence and sealed mandates and all these different scenarios that we went through. And so it wasn't entirely a surprise, but I think if you remember the context, there was always another option. There was what John called the doomsday coalition. So it's not as though the DA had all of the negotiating cards, all of the aces at the table. We had one or two aces, but very few indeed, because we were always very aware of the fact that the primary purpose was avoiding an ANC, MK, EFF, doomsday coalition. Now, we have no idea to what extent the ANC was flirting with those other destructive movements, but at the time we had no idea, and so that was always in the back of our mind very clearly. That would have been deeply irresponsible to South Africa to allow them to form a government. It would have been utterly disastrous for the future of the country, and South Africa would look very different today if that government had come to pass. So it's not the case that we had all of the chips at the table. And that's why it's so important that we carry on growing and even faster if we can, so that we have, as I said, we move from a finger to a hand on the steering wheel of the state.
The question though, Jordan, being what sort of arrangement would the DA want? Let's assume the voting stays pretty much the same. You all win what you won, and the scary thing about the EFF and MK is still there. So the conditions are the same, except you've had more time to think about how you structure the GNU. What would you do differently?
Sorry, there's just another part of your previous question that I didn't answer. Notwithstanding what I've said, I do think that we need to do a lot more preparation ahead of 2029 for what the ministerial and regulatory powers are in each ministry, that we might be strategic about what ministries are on the table or off the table. You will remember, and it's come out in those books, that there was a brief moment when trade and industry was on the table. After we had accepted it in writing, then it was unilaterally and I think quite dishonorably removed from the table.
Yeah.
But that's all water under the bridge now. But we've got to have a very clear idea of what we want and what we want to do in those portfolios. And I think that preparation can happen well in advance of 2029, because it is likely, very, very likely, overwhelmingly likely, actually, that this coalition model is
all
here
right.
to
well,
stay.
You've answered the question. You know, who knows what will happen to the EFF or the MK party? The MK is alive for as long as Jacob Zuma is, I presume, and then it's not there. But, you know, does its vote go back to the ANC or part of the ANC, whatever it might be? We don't know. But Jordan Hillous, I'm going to set you free now. Thank you so much for joining me here. And
thank you, Peter.
And thank you all for listening too. And it's been great. And Jordan, thank you very much. And good luck for your conference in April. I've been invited, actually. I may come and watch your investiture.
thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you, Peter.